Today is the 20th of November, and I'm here with Vice Admiral Robert George at CERN in Victoria.
So just to get a better idea for the research, perhaps you could tell me a bit about what our Navy was doing just prior to the platform.
Yes, I think just to give you some background, the kinds of things that Canada's Navy was doing, with no surprise. I mean, we were supporting naval activities, and we frequently had a ship in the Standing Naval Force Atlantic, which really occupied a lot of resources in support of that role. And on the West Coast, we, in fact, just had finished a major exercise with allies in the Pacific, known as RIMPAC. That would have been RIMPAC 90. And also, people tend to forget that our operations on the West Coast also are involved with Canada-US Regional Planning Group, which is a branch of activities involved with NATO as well. So the Navy was continuing to pursue the aim of maximizing interoperability with allies. Those include Australian forces frequently, New Zealand forces, naval forces, maritime air forces, as well as with some of the other Asian nations that were participating in RIMPAC at that time, which would be Japan, soon to be Korea. So the Navy was pursuing this interoperability target, which really had as a key communications. In other words, if we could communicate with allies in the Pacific as well as in the Atlantic, doing naval operations, doing maritime operations at sea, based on what originally had been a primary role of anti-submarine warfare, but in fact branched out into surface warfare, and with new capabilities coming into the Navy, we were feeling more confident about our anti-air capability as well. And by doing so, we had developed skills that were most useful in operations of that next decade. And that was one of controlling an area, maritime area, being able to know what was going on in a maritime area by way of surveillance and keeping track of every activity that was going on in a maritime area. And this kind of capability was what was found to be most useful as we became involved in maritime operations concerning the Persian Gulf War, and in later years, operations on the Adriatic. So our Navy, I think, had maximized opportunities with allies to develop the capability to operate with any maritime nation, any friendly or allied maritime nation in the world. In the reaches, far reaches of the Pacific as well as in the Atlantic, we had done that, I think, to a maximum.
The role our government wanted for the Navy in the Gulf, was there, or were you aware of any restrictions or political decisions on what we were going to do or what we could do?
I'm certainly aware of those. The bottom line was the government wanted a meaningful role for Canada in our operations in the Persian Gulf War. And that was something that was constantly being expressed by both our minister and others in that were involved in talking to the public. The minister, who at that time was Minister McKnight, had repeatedly said that we had to be effective, to do useful work, and that our expression of this had to be consistent as we talked and explained our role to Canadians. The government and the cabinet, in fact, was frequently briefed by our chief defense staff and other staffs in the HQ from early on. And I'll remind you that about the same time, they were also engaged with the OCA crisis. So it wasn't that there weren't any other crises on the table at the time. But this involvement of Canada in the Persian Gulf, which the government had said was to contribute to the international effort in response to Iraq's action against Kuwait in accordance with our defense and foreign policy objectives. But they were also aware that there was going to be a threat and a risk involved in putting maritime forces in Canada's forces into the Persian Gulf. And so initially, as the announcements were being made through August, day by day, about Canada's role and repeated questioning about what we were going to do and how we were going to do it and how, as I've expressed before, our worn-out ships were going to be able to survive in such an environment, the government and the cabinet made the department aware that they were concerned about our capabilities and that if we were confident that we were going to be able to meet those threats, that we should express those confidences publicly so that the public who had been given an impression of an incapable Navy being rebuilt at the time should feel confident that this decision to send maritime forces off to the Persian Gulf was not an unwise decision. And therefore, the restrictions as we first started to define the role of the Canadian task group, and that was a naval task group at the early stages during August, up until the time the ship sailed. When I say a naval task group, really a maritime task group that included maritime air, and that we had seeking helicopters on board our fleet. This restriction ended up being an interpretation that the Canadian ships would remain outside the Gulf of Oman and that they would be given or be able to participate in meaningful operations outside the Gulf of Oman. And so as the ship sailed in the early days of September, as they frequently had discussions about what the maritime forces were going to do, and various people, including the commander of the task group and defense representatives in terms of our defense liaison staffs in Washington and London, had an opportunity to discuss with our allies what was required to be done and how Canada could fit into doing that. Those discussions gave way to what eventually became a modification of the role. But as these meetings took place and Commodore Summers went to certain meetings and Admiral Anderson and his staff participated in various meetings, both in that part of the world, in the Middle East and in Europe, the proposal came from the commander task group that there was an important role that Canada could do inside the Gulf, in the southern Persian Gulf. And I received that recommendation from the commander task group early in September, and I instructed the commander of the Maritime Warfare School, the commandant of the Maritime Warfare School, to do an analysis of the capabilities and the threat, and to advise me on whether or not the Maritime Warfare School considered this to be a reasonable role for the maritime forces to engage themselves in. And on the 13th of September, in fact, I was advised by the Commandant of the Maritime Warfare School that they were supportive of the proposed change in the operation area. I passed that on to National Defense Headquarters with my recommendations of support, and in view of the restrictions placed on what we could do or where we could go, those restrictions we felt were more restrictive than necessary. So that's how our role evolved from being one of maritime surveillance outside the Persian Gulf, the Gulf of Oman, to a role inside, which leads you into your next question.
The role we ended up with, did it evolve much from the plan that was initially in the proposal you received?
Well, in fact, it certainly did, and it was as a result of frequent meetings with our allies in defining what needed to be done in the Persian Gulf, what the risks were, what defensive capabilities were available in terms of air cover from other allies, because we had no air cover at the time. And I think the whole process, from the time the government made a decision to do something, to contribute to an international effort, was something that grew and developed day by day. And therefore, as you will recall, it was in September that the government then decided to provide tactical air forces to the Persian Gulf effort from Canada, which then really changed our role, and it also changed my role, and it even changed the commander of the task group's role, in that he now had joint forces that he was responsible for, and he was responsible for that those joint forces directly to NDHQ. So the role that Canada took on within the Gulf in terms of monitoring a large area and also being able to involving the protector in terms of the support for maritime forces operating in the area had been one that had developed over the weeks and during the many discussions, when it was evident that one of the big shortcomings was AOR resources, in other words, the tanker resources, in an area that would be safe to operate, and that we could ensure that that tanker was well protected from any threat. So the roles that we took on in the Persian Gulf, which both the Commander Task Group and the Commander Joint Task Force will give you in great detail, did involve us moving from an area that was less threatened into one with a higher risk. And there had been early on some concern about enemy Exocet and Silkworm capabilities in terms of missile threats. And we had to satisfy ourselves that we could cope with those threats within the new operating area. Also, I think at the time we had to make sure that the Canadian public understood why we were changing our area of operations, because they had been given this information early on based on what we knew at the time about the requirement that we'd operate outside the Persian Gulf. And this, to many, said, oh, well, all of a sudden you're changing all the rules or what the conditions were that you're going to operate under. And therefore, we had a challenge on our hands to make sure that from back home, the public understood the importance of the role we were taking, the minimal risk that was involved, and the fact that this would give Canada a more meaningful role in the whole operation. And last but by no means least, we had families to consider who all of a sudden saw their loved ones being put into a totally different area of operations, and hence great concern on their part about the safety of their loved ones. So these were huge challenges to be faced with, and we took on a very aggressive public information activity. We had from the outset given access to the media. The media had sailed with the ships. The media had joined the ships in transiting the Mediterranean. They had joined for the passage through the canal, and they were present out in the Persian Gulf. We had no filing restrictions on them. We had watched, I think, learned from the experience of other navies in the last few years where attempts to restrict the filing of items from the operation area had, to be frank, brought on, been quite disastrous. So we had from the start an open policy for our media, and I think in the end it paid off, because the line that was being carried by the media through their own observations was in fact being supported by the messages that were being given in Halifax and Ottawa. And the great risk in this public information program was that there wouldn't be consistency between what was being said in Ottawa or in Halifax or out in the fleet. And therefore, we worked very hard at making sure that we stayed on top of developments hourly if necessary. And there were no surprises in headquarters about activities and decisions being made about the operations of the forces. So I think the success of that whole activity was dependent upon communications between the various levels of command, and we worked to make sure those were quite open and successful.
So that some of the key players are making decisions regarding our role. I see in books and in the media, people when they're speaking with, I'm just curious if who the real movers and shakers were.
Well, and in some ways, sometimes you say, well, who really made the decision? The commander in the operating area had guidance, and he had rules of engagement that allowed him to make decisions on the spot without having to resort to asking the chain of command for permission to do something. So that's why it's important that the commander in the field had clear guidance both from me, and he had rules of engagement that had been approved within the department and, in some cases, by the government. So when these decisions about, for example, the operating area were being taken. Many times they were based on recommendations from the commander in the field, in the operating area, through me with my endorsement to the Chief of Defense Staff. And the Chief of Defense Staff at the time was actively engaged as well in operations in Oka, and therefore he was frequently seeing the Minister of Defense. He was frequently seeing the Deputy Minister, Mr. Fowler, who was very active in the discussions around decisions. I won't say the decisions, but the discussions around the decisions, especially as they were taken to government or to the minister. So in the case of, for example, the use of force, those rules of engagement would have had the endorsement of the CDS and the blessing, I would say the blessing of the government at the time, the cabinet. The Minister of Defense, Mr. McKnight, was very involved in the day-to-day exploration of new issues. And the CDS would frequently be involved in discussions with the minister if it was deemed of such importance that government needed to be involved in things like, for example, a change in operating area or the decision to bring in other kinds of forces, like bringing in air forces. Those would be taken as a recommendation from the department to the cabinet. And once that decision had been made by cabinet, then the CDS had the authority to get on and do whatever we had to do to make that happen. And and as the forces expanded in the Persian Gulf and it became a joint task force, and it was joint JTF-1, and that was the first one. And I recall in later years, when I say in our modern times anyways, joint task force, that usage, JTF-1, was the Persian Gulf task force. As you know, JTF-2 today is the special services one. And it was decided by CDS that as after the Gulf War, we would preserve that JTF-1 name as the JTF for Persian Gulf. Whether it will ever be activated again as JTF-1, I'm not sure, but we've actually saved the name of that part of history, JTF-1. That I hope answers how the decisions were being made. I was making decisions in terms of the support of those forces. As the situation developed, the decisions on the operations were being made in the HQ, but the decisions on the support of those operations came from Halifax. Involved the staffs there, but never in isolation, I don't think, from the maritime staffs in NDHQ.
This kind of ties in. Did the command and control structure in the CF and Navy change much in response to our deployment?
I think it would be fair to say that, like our allies, we had been talking about more capability for joint operations within the Canadian forces. And as the years developed and staffs changed and were modified in terms of how they reported and what their responsibilities were in NDHQ, And I think it's fair to say it has continued for the last 20 years and maybe culminated in what's happening today with the new command structure for the Canadian Forces. There was a recognition that we had to do more in terms of our ability to operate in a joint environment with our Army and the Air Force colleagues. So I would like to think that the experience of the Persian Gulf War, the transformation, if you will, from a naval task group leaving Halifax and growing into a joint task force, which then was responsible for to National Defense Headquarters for a joint operation, was an early testing ground and a proving ground for a concept that obviously will work. And how it will work is based on experience of knowing what you can task, how you can make it happen, how the support commands can participate in that kind of an organization, joint organization. I think the proof is in the pudding in terms of what really happened in the Persian Gulf. It was a success. The joint operations were successful. The joint staff came together there most successfully. The maritime operations did not suffer as a result of changing personalities, changing the command structure. And the speak for the air operation, I think from, as an observer, the command and control functions worked. Now, that's not to say there weren't improvements and there couldn't be improvements, and probably one of the things that it proved was that we needed more communications and better communications amongst our forces out there and to our headquarters back home. And those are not new lessons. I think every exercise or every operation we're in, there is always a demand for more capability and communication. So I think this sort of wraps it up in terms of saying, yes, it did change the way we approached our operations and our attitude toward operation and the realization in maritime headquarters that there were going to be cases where our naval forces were going to go into joint operations and we wouldn't be the controlling agency anymore. And in many ways, that makes sense when the operations are being conducted on such a scale with such international impact. Okay.
Thank you. Just at this time, is there anything you'd like to add discussed?
I think one of the other areas related a little bit to the joint operations question is the fact that these ships sailed with obviously they sailed with air personnel on board because we had Sea King helicopters as part of our fleet, but we brought in Javelin and blowpipe operators from the Army and integrated them into our maritime forces. And that was quite an accomplishment, I think. And it speaks well both for the ability of what was then Mobile Command and Maritime Command to work together to put together a capability that the Navy needed and the Army was in possession of, and they were willing and able to integrate themselves into a naval vessel's operation. And, of course, that goes without saying that the Maritime Air Side and Air Command, especially in the early stages where we had to make major upgrades to the Sea King helicopter, which in itself is a whole new story in terms of what capability we added. And I think I may have referred to it in the past about how things that might have taken months in the past in terms of getting engineering approval to make a modification, like mounting a weapon inside a helicopter or putting on an infrared capability in the helicopter, would have taken months, if not years, was solved in a matter of days at Shearwater, both from an approval point of view and an engineering point of view, and then finally an implementation point. So the stories that have tended to focus on what the dockyard was capable of, and in fact it was phenomenal what they did, were being repeated in Mobile Command and in Air Command as well. So I think it's important to realize that this, right from the start, was an undertaking that involved the three services. We may hear a lot about inability to work together or need to.